Good morning. My name is Jamie, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey,
hey y'all. It was really funny. I'm a big Facebook fan, and I just have to read this real quick because I knew I was going to be telling my story, and this is only the third time, so you guys bear with me a little bit. But it came up, and it says, sometimes God redeems your story by surrounding you with people who need to hear it, hear your past, so that it doesn't become their future. And if that would be my fondest wish from telling, having to get up here and tell them my story, that people relate to it and that they don't have to go as far down the elevator as I did. I was born on January 5th, 1955. My sobriety date is January 20th, 2010. So I have had a long and colorful career with my drinking and using. My parents were both alcoholics. When I was born, I think they were well on their way. And then a little over four years later, my brother was born, and I understand that my mom drank throughout the pregnancy, and I'll always believe that my brother suffered from that when he was born. But be that as it may, alcoholism ran in our family. My dad, all of his, every single one, he had like six brothers and sisters, and all the brothers were alcoholic. They drank alcoholically, some recovered, some not. My grandmother's brother on my mother's side was the town drunk in a little town called Buchanan, Georgia. So it wasn't foreign to our family, although my mother had a sister. Those were my grandmama's two children, two girls. And my Aunt Helen was an alcoholic. She was not. She never really liked drinking, and I am so grateful to her and my grandmother, my mom's mom, because without them, I don't think I would ever have known anything about what a regular life was like. Throughout my childhood, I was able to spend time with my aunt and uncle and her son, Mark, who's like my cousin brother. And I got an idea because I was a very lonely child and I didn't have a lot of friends. We lived in a small house on Austell Road, and it was like a two-bedroom. In fact, me and my brother slept with my grandmother until I was age 10 in the other bedroom while my parents fought and carried on. And so my childhood was filled with fear and uncertainty, and you just never knew, unpredictability. We'd go on vacation and they would drink and they would start to fight, and my dad would drive really fast. I remember covering my little brother in the back seat, a floorboard, because I didn't know if we were going to crash or not. We got thrown out of hotels. And we didn't know, we didn't really understand what the deal was. And then when I was 10, my father was killed in an automobile accident. They had one of their biggest fights ever the night before, and they would drag us into it. And I had a sponge in my hand. And my mom had us both, and it was always like, if you love these children, you wouldn't do this or you would do that or whatever. And I remember throwing the sponge at my dad and saying, I hate you. And what I hated was the way we lived. And I didn't know what to do about it. And the next day he was killed. And so that stuck with me for a very long time. I'm very non-confrontational. When he was killed, they had just bought a house in Marietta in Whitlock Heights. And we were so hopeful. We thought, Jimmy and I, my brother, if we just moved there, that things would get better. We were sure that that was the solution. And we never lived in that house. It was sold, and my mom decided to move to Decatur to be near her sister and her family. She had always worked. She had recently, before the move, was working for a law firm. She always worked for law firms, and she was their controller. She was a very smart woman. She was a very strong and strong-willed person, and she had my grandmother who always babysat us so she could work. And she wanted better things. Anyway, she she proceeded to drink and work herself to death over the next 8 years. And so, you know, in terms of having friends and having people over, joining groups and things like that, it didn't happen. So I was an extremely lonely child. I began to read, and I lived in books. During that time, when we moved, I became alienated at school. I pissed off the wrong people. And, you know, so I began to experience a lot of, you know, cruelty from the other kids and stuff like that. And I, you know, my instinct is to fight back, and that was really the wrong thing to do. But I got a big chip on my shoulder as a result of all of that, because I never felt like one of those people. I was always something apart from. So it was a lot of trauma, a lot of, you know, I never learned how to live in this world, really. There was nobody. It was like my mom expected certain things of us, but we were just supposed to know it, you know. Anyway, I had my very first drink at age 16. I mean, I hated that my mother would work and come home and drink and pass out, work and go home and drink and pass out. And we hated it. And every now and then, my aunt would come over, and she and my grandmother would go through the closets in the bathroom and under the beds and have huge garbage sacks full of bottles and get rid of them. And nobody ever talked about it. You know, nobody ever talked about what the real problem was. It was like the proverbial white elephant in the living room. And so we didn't know. But it was so funny because by the time I hit high school, which we didn't have middle school in Decatur at that time, and you went straight from 7th grade in elementary to 8th grade in high school, and I found that the wrong crowd was always recruiting, whereas the right crowd was very particular about who they allowed to join their ranks. So, you know, I gravitated toward the people who skipped the school and smoked and whatever. But I was actually 16 before I had my first drink. I was in study hall with a girl named Shelby Pritchard. I remember, and Shelby was a pretty girl. She was a fairly popular girl. And she said to me, "I'm going to bring something, a surprise for us tomorrow." And I said, "Okay." Because I would do anything for people to like me. And I carried that through most of my teenage years and into my adulthood, really. But the next day, she said, "Come on, let's assess and go to the bathroom." And we went to the bathroom. And she had two little airplane bottles of whiskey from her parents. You know, I say, I'd never seen one. The only ones I saw were really big quart bottles. So, you know, it didn't occur to me. We each went in our stall, opened the bottle, drank the stuff down. Mine went down like silk, warm. I've never felt anything like that before. Suddenly, everything was okay. I wasn't afraid. I was prettier. I was smarter. All in that second. Shelby, on the other hand, is gagging and throwing up because she didn't even get hers. I don't think hers hit her stomach. I should have known right then. But I didn't. And so I began to persuade my boyfriend, who lived across the street, to, you know, he worked at the drugstore behind the counter. They did that back then. And they had a delivery lady, and she would buy him a pint of whiskey every now and again when we'd go on a date. So, you know, I lost my virginity and started drinking in my 16th year. But I remember I had one friend, Paula, and I went to pick her up. And by then, I started sneaking some of my mom's in the bathroom cabinet because, wow, no wonder. You know, and I said, "You've got to try this. This is so wonderful. It is just the greatest thing ever." And she's like, "Well, I don't know about that." But anyway, that started me on my drinking career. And then a little later on, Larry started bringing home some pills from the drugstore. He had started smoking pot. Fortunately, I never liked pot. I didn't like the way it felt. I wanted to be in control. So my first drug was a Black Beauty, an RJS, and I thought I was God with that, you know? And I'd always loved English and literature, and I was, of course, a big reader. Lonely children, I guess, are. But I thought I was going to be the next F. Scott Fitzgerald. And I began to write, and, you know, it's easy to do when you're speeding your brains out. And, you know, so I always liked the upside of drugs. Anyway, that went on, and finally he quit because he was sure that Dr. Jones was going to find him out anyway. I started drinking and drugging in 1971. I really liked the drugs better than the booze, because with booze, I lost control. I mean, I never didn't drink alcoholically. And I graduated early in 1972. Ostensibly, I went to summer school and skipped the 11th grade. I was glad to get the hell out of there. I hated school. By this time, I pretty much hated myself, but I didn't know that then. And it was for my grandmother, who was getting up in age, and she said, why don't you do this, and then your grandmother can be there to see it. And really, I think she knew at that time it was going to be her. And so I did, and I started a community college, and this was great. I met all these people who had drugs and got into I had a hippie boyfriend, and you know, if you didn't go, they didn't call your parents. They didn't call home. You didn't have to have a note. And so I flunked out my first quarter. We had quarters back then, and that didn't go over too well at all. And my mom and I had a big fight. I had had my tonsils taken out when I was 17, right after graduation, and they gave you the most coolest liquid in a bottle. And so, you know, of course, I finished that, but then I refilled it at some point, and she got on the phone with the pharmacist, and, you know, I became the big drug addict, blah, 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 blah. So I left, and I went to live with my aunt for a few months until I was 18, and then I moved into an apartment. I was a proofreader for a law book firm for a while. Continued to drink, continued to drug. You know, what I didn't know about drugs, my boyfriend Freddie introduced me to. So, you know, what I have come to realize in my recovery is sick people pick sick people. And boy, I picked a lot of them, and they picked me. And so I hadn't had any legal trouble up to this point. We got married in 1976. My drinking increased to a point. I got a job in Tucker, and I got kind of into my job, and I quit doing drugs for a while. I kind of lost touch with the folks who did those things, but I still drank a lot, and we partied, and we had friends that did that. And then in 1980, I became pregnant with my first son. And back then, you didn't know. I knew I didn't do drugs, but I still smoked, and I still drank. And but I did try to kind of control it, and I was a really happy pregnant person. I was looking forward to my son's birth, and when he was born, he was just, you know, it was just great. But then the drinking crept in. One of my aunt's neighbors said, you know, if you want to have more milk, then you drink some beer, a beer. Well, I drank a six pack, you know, every day, sitting there. And then you know, I wasn't a very good mom. And I was really unhappy. And Freddie and I had become not so nice to each other. We hung in there, and then we bought a house in 1983. My mom had left my brother and I an estate, a pretty nice one at the time, in 1973 when she died. And she had it through CNS Bank, and we could only get money for things, and we had a little allowance thing until we were both 25. Anyway, long story short, you know, that enabled me to have a car here and a car there, and I put the down payment on the house, and then Freddie had gone to work for a civil engineering firm as a surveyor, and he cut his hand and then ended up in the office. He did graduate 2 years of college as a Bachelor of Arts, not Bachelor, Associates of Arts. He was an artist. And, you know, I don't know. Some by guy came to work there, and he started coming home late, and they were doing cocaine. And, you know, one night I talked to my aunt every day. We were just down the street from her, and one night he came in, and the baby was asleep. Joel was asleep, and dinner, of course, was ruined. And I was sitting on the stool in the kitchen. We still had corded phones back then. And I was sitting there talking to her, and he came in, and he decided that I was talking about him because he couldn't have anybody know that he was really an asshole or a sick guy. Anyway, he hit me. And I think sometimes when we cross a certain line, then it becomes easier to do each time. So we got very physical with each other. And there came a point, Joel was, he was like 4. And that New Year's Eve, we had a terrible bout, and I was tied up and had socks stuck in my mouth. Anyway, it was a really bad scene, and he left the house, and he decided that he was going to get a divorce. And as bad as I hated him at that point and hated, you know, our life together, I was absolutely terrified, and I didn't know what to do. And so I drank. And then his parents arranged a deal that if I would go, there was the first alcohol recovery program or treatment program at Decatur Hospital, developed by a guy named Dr. Allard. And if I would go into treatment for 30 days, then we'd get some counseling and see if we could work on things. And it was like my little life raft. Okay, all right, because I didn't know how to live without, I don't know, it was too terrifying. Anyway, long story short, it didn't work out so well because I was served with divorce papers, and it ended up he had gotten an attorney who was also a recovering alcoholic but was one of the meanest guys ever. And I was just, I got a guy who was involved in the program and a really nice man and very worked his program, but I didn't go over too well in court, and I lost the, when I went into treatment, he changed the locks on the house and took Joel. And I had seen how he acted with Joel at times and shaking him and things, and you know, I just wasn't about to leave my baby with him, and yet I couldn't. I was the self-proclaimed alcoholic because I went into treatment, and things just got worse, and I went back to drinking after treatment, and they escalated. When I went back to my job, I didn't get go back to the same job at Macy's. I had to work for somebody in retail, and I didn't know anything about that, and I was just a wreck. And so it came to a point he would call about money and hold my visitations with Joel. He'd say, I'll give you more time if you can give me more money. Anyway, I got drunker and crazier and drunker and crazier and thin and didn't eat. One day I decided, well, I was really mad at him, and I went and broke into the house, and I took his shotgun and hid it in the house. And Devi, that's my aunt and uncle, Devi and Big Daddy, they were the official grandparents when Joel was born. They called me and they said, you know, you can't do this. I know, you know, we know you got it. You know, you threw his fine leather shoes in the bathtub with water. We know it's you. And instead of listening to anybody, I went over to some of the people that I knew that drank and drugged like I did, and really drunk, and went to the house and waited. And he came home early to fix where I'd broken in, and thank God he didn't pick up the baby at daycare, because we had some words. And all I remember thinking is, I can't win. I never win. And I shot him. And I was blessed that even at that time that an attorney in our church, Mount Carmel Christian Church, stepped up to the plate and said, he reduced his rates. And he was very well known. He had been a former prosecutor. And somehow he got he arranged a plea deal for voluntary manslaughter, 12 years to do 4. And when I was arrested, I had stayed in jail the whole time. There was no bond. And I could not imagine not going home. I couldn't imagine. I got to see my son one time. And while I was in jail, my in-laws came and snatched. Well, they they called my family, DB and Big Daddy, and they said, I want to talk, you know, whatever, I want to see him. And then they wouldn't bring him back, and they sued for custody. Anyway, long story short, I did 4 years, some of which was done in a transition center here in Atlanta. And you would have thought, well, that would have been enough, right? And when I walked out, because I had messed up at the halfway house and gotten involved with one of the guards, because when I went to jail, I decided men were awful. Women were better. Because I was a sick person, and it wouldn't have mattered what, if it was an alien from Mars, if they'd been available here, I would have picked the sickest motherfucker out there. And so I got sent back for my last 8 months, and then when I walked out, they actually paroled me on time. And it still wasn't enough, and my drinking escalated. I had gotten a job with a granite marble company as a secretary when I was at the transition center. And the my boss, Chris Schultz, said, when you get out and you need a job, call me, when I'd had to go back. And so, of course, that's what I did, because it was easy. And I went back to work there and eventually went into sales, and actually did really well with it. When he divorced his wife, we began to see each other, and married in 1991. And I was doing really well with sales, and we had our younger son, Jackson, and I became my mother. I worked and I drank and I used. I was sober through the pregnancy. I was sober because I went to Ridgeview, failed that, and went on to a small place in Gwinnett County where I actually made a little progress. Realized that, you know, part that I had a lot of pain and anger stored up. I never knew my parents, you know. I'd been looking for my dad for years and other men. And, you know, I really didn't love Chris. I didn't think I loved him when I married him, but he was able to do things. You know, he had a good job and he had cars and money, some money. And anyway, so, I got back to drinking when Jackson was less than a year old. And so I would just hide it, you know, off and on. I struggled with that for many years, but I was a real good salesperson, and I made a lot of money, and we built a house in 99, and, you know, my older son, when Jackson was born, Joel was 12, and he came to live with us, and I just treated him like a redheaded stepchild. You know, I didn't know how to be anybody's mother. Anyway, I struggled over the years in my marriage and my relationships and my job. My job defined me. It was the only thing that I had that made me feel like I was worth anything. And eventually, my drinking and drug use, I got back into cocaine and crack this time. And it brought that to a halt. My husband divorced me in 2008, and I'm so glad that he did. Wished he'd done it sooner, because it enabled me to be out on my own and have to deal with my consequences. And I hooked up with somebody else in the program who, again, was sicker than I was, who was going to be my new fix-it guy, and that didn't happen because he couldn't stay sober long enough. I was used to a sober fix-it guy because Chris doesn't drink. I wasn't used to another drunk, you know, and that didn't work out too well. I was living in an extended stay hotel situation. I had gotten hooked up with some really dangerous crackhead people and dealers over in Marietta. It's amazing what's behind those big houses on Church Street. I lived very dangerously all through my drinking and drug use. You know, I actually had somebody jump in a car in Atlanta one night with it looked like a semi-automatic machine gun thing, and he said, give me your purse, and I said, I'll run your ass into the mailbox, and I proceeded to do that, and he jumped out and said, you're crazy, and I was. You know, I went through the the projects before the Olympic Village. I was down there trying to score cocaine, and they grabbed my watch and stuff, and I went running after him. You know, I mean, it was just bizarre stuff. I should not be standing here today telling this story. Anyway, long story short, I went to Knoxville to work for a competitor and thought that I could pull myself together. And I had started coming into the rooms in what I call Semi East Cobb, St. Andrews, and Covenant, and that in 2005. Never did any of the work. Eventually, got a sponsor, lied, cheated, picked up chips I didn't deserve. I saw people come in those rooms right out of Ridgeview, right shaken from their detox, whatever, and get sober and not drink again. I saw them do that, and I didn't do it. You know, I was not one of you guys. I was not going to be my mother. And it almost killed me, that denial. And then it took another year and a half to finally crash. I ended up going to jail 3 times in quick succession in 2009. And then twice, and then right after the new year, I was back in there. And, of course, my partner came and got my purse, and I released it. I had discovered that I had my 401k from my 20 years at my other job, and it was substantial. And he helped me to tap into that during my second jail stay. So when I got out, you know, we had money, and it didn't last very long. And I had asked the administrator to liquidate it in that January of 2010. And fortunately, he could not transfer it because my bank account was on hold because I had bounced checks. And anyway, long story short, I got arrested at the bank trying to deposit the check and get money back because, you know, the bank wanted to hold it. And the cops came, and I was just an absolute mess. I was about 90 pounds, and I had peed my pants. It was just awful. And I went to jail, and I cursed that cop, and my first year of recovery, I wrote him a thank you note. Because I was on probation from the other thing, and I had to sit there for a while, and it's the first time of any length of time that I actually was able to kind of come out of my alcoholic and drug-induced cloud. And I was sitting in the day room at Cobb County Jail. This is the old one. With some of the women who were there for the same as a direct cause of their drinking or using, listening to them talk about how they couldn't wait to get back out and do it some more. And I thought, I am just like these women. This is me, and this is what I have to look forward to. I'm so grateful for those 5 years of being in the rooms. I didn't get sober in the rooms, but I went to a lot of meetings because it seemed like that's the only place I felt comfortable anymore and accepted. And so I knew everything that they had ever told me began to click. You know, one day at a time suddenly made sense. Take it easy made sense. You know, 90 and 90, I just hit my knees. I went up to my little cell thing, and I hit my knees, and I said, I'm now willing to do whatever it takes. Please, I don't want to do this anymore. And I had a probation hearing, and that night I prayed like I never prayed before, and I was able to actually just go to sleep and leave it in God's hands. And my little attorney, he was a court-appointed guy, he's really a nice guy, and I had called him after I first got arrested, and he thought that was so amazing because I was so embarrassed to have to call him and say I'm back in from the other time. And anyway, he fought long and hard, and I had already made a commitment because he asked me when I called him that time. He said, what are you willing to do? And I said, anything, residential rehab, you know, whatever it took. And he said, okay, and he went before them, and he came back, and he said, well, they're willing to do, you've got two options. You can stay in here 90 days for your probation violation and get out and be back on probation like nothing ever happened. Or you can stay 35 more days and go to treatment. And I said, I'm going to go to treatment. And I really thought I was going to the extension, but that didn't work out. Because by this time, my money had cleared. Of course, you know, my partner was going through some of it, you know, whatever. But it was amazing while I was in jail. I spoke with his parents, and his mother actually went over there and got my purse and debit card and checkbook and all of that and gave it to my... By then... 17-year-old son, Jackson, and I remember talking to him on the phone there in the jail, and he said, Mom, you've just got to learn how to stop going to jail. And, you know, I think about that often now, because it's been a while since I've seen one, thank goodness, but, you know, I got out, and when I didn't do the extension, they said, you need to go to Hope Homes, because I had some money in the bank. I had a family that you know, Chris had come and bailed me out. He had taken over the power of attorney for my bank account. You know, I had. My family had been waiting a long time for me to get sober and to become the person that God meant for me to be. And I didn't know that then, and I didn't know anything other than I was tired of, I couldn't think for myself anymore, so I had to put myself somewhere where people did it for me. I could not be left to my own devices. I was too afraid of that. So I went to Hope Homes, still had my 8th DUI pinned, 7th and 8th. And I loved it there. Everybody was focused on recovery, pretty much. You know, it was the first time I learned to live independently of other people. You know, I got a recovery job. Gradually learned to tell the truth. I went to a lot of meetings. I've always loved the meetings. I actually got a sponsor, and she was somebody I had known in the rooms before. You know, by the time of 2009, 2008, 2000, people in the program, they cared, but they drew away from me because it's like one of my good friends said. He said, you know, if you keep going like you're going, you're going to go out, and you're going to go out with a bang, and we're afraid to be part of that, you know, because it really, there's no telling what would have happened. But anyway, so I got the sponsor, and I did what they said to do. We worked the steps. Things were making a lot of sense to me. My first step, you know, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable, suddenly was very easy to understand and to see. You know, she explained it like if you're in a theater and you picked your seat and the seat's not really the right seat, you know, and it begins to be uncomfortable and the springs, they sprung, and I kept trying to sit in that seat, no matter how awkward and painful and crazy it got. And when I got into recovery, I said, oh, maybe I'll try that seat over there. You know, the pain of staying the same became greater than the pain of changing or the fear of changing. And it was easy at Hope Homes. I had a wonderful counselor. She was the first person I actually completely trusted. And I was able to sit down with her. I had been trying to get a job in my old industry. I had no car, no license. You know, none of that, but I still felt entitled. And when it didn't work out, and she just happened to call me, and she said, I'm coming over. We all lived in an apartment complex in Smyrna, and she came, and she was talking to me, and I just looked at her, and I started to cry, and I said, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know how to do this. And that was a turning point for me, to admit that I didn't know something, because I couldn't admit that before. You know, I had to be armored. I had to be the Valkyrie, because I couldn't let you know how torn up and scared and all that. But anyway, I got my 1-year chip. And one of my really good friends from the rooms, who had never given up on me, even though we didn't talk very much anymore, I asked him to give me my chip at Unity. And I'll never forget, as I was sitting there, the whole women's community from Hope Homes with my counselor filed into the room. And Matthew said, when he was giving me my chip, he said, if you people don't think there's a God and you don't think AA works, then you look at this woman and it's bound to change your mind, because we knew she was going to die. We just knew she was going to be one of those people that, you know, disappear, and then somebody was going to say, oh, did you hear what happened to Jamie, you know, blah, blah, blah. But she's standing here, and she hasn't picked up a drink or a jug in a year. And all of these girls are sitting there, because I never truly felt like I had anything worthwhile to offer people or to make people, to inspire people or whatever. And all those people showed up for that, and that was awesome. And I had actually not had a drink in a year. When I first went to St. Andrews and people were picking up chips, I'm like, there's no freaking way those people didn't drink. It was inconceivable to me that you could actually live and not drink. But you know, you can. And I worked those steps, and I've developed a relationship with a higher power. I didn't always agree with my sponsor, but I tried to do what she asked me to do, and she was a really great sponsor for me for the first 3 years of my recovery. I loved Hope Homes. Went to court in November of 2010 on that 7th and 8th DUI. We'd been continuing it for months because, let me go back, I was probably, because when I got to Hope Homes, I already had 65 days clean. You know, to me, sober is a state of mind, it's a state of being. So I wasn't really sober living, but I was clean. And I became, they taught me how to live sober. But I had the little job at the mall that I eventually lost because I hadn't been honest about my legal record. But and I learned my honesty lesson then. But a girl came to pick me up after work, and she said, she said, you need to call Shay, our counselor. So I did, and she says, honey, you need to call your attorney. Blah, 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 he's been calling. So I called him, and I said, what's up, Lee? And he said, well, I just want to prepare you because the judge is asking for you to do 2 years in jail. And I'm like, holy fuck, you know, because I've been there quite a bit. And I knew what it was like, and I didn't really want to go back. And, you know, my first thought of thinking is, well, I've done this really good stuff, and now you want to punish me, you know? We're such egoists. Anyway, this voice came to me. By that time, Big Daddy had passed away, and God bless him. DV was in her the first stages of dementia. But I remember something that he said. This voice came, and he said, it's not over till the fat lady sings. That was his little thing that he said a lot. And it came to me, and I thought, okay, instead of running right around the corner to the liquor store, because there was one there by the apartment complex when I get back, because that was where I was headed, you know, fuck this. Let's just wait and see. When I got to the apartment, my counselor was there, my roommate, who I had become to love, and she's like a sister now, was there, and we talked, and I cried, and we had one of our groups that night, and Shay made me share, you know, what was going on. And she said, if you go to jail, you'll go to jail differently this time. You've got people that are, you know, friends and whatever. So that was my first hurdle on faith. And as it turned out, when I went to court in November, I had about 10 months sober under my belt. And my judge sentenced me, instead of to prison or to jail, to 2 months at Hope Homes, retro to the April that I got there, which was the biggest blessing God could have given me, because it took the decision of, Their thing was, you know, your commitment was 6 months, and then of course you could stay, and they had stages you could go through. It took that decision out of my hands, because I was sure I would have left too soon. And so I was there for 2 years, and I worked in their office for a long time. I considered a career in recovery. I built a firm foundation in this program. I began to rely on my higher power. I was offered a counselorship, and I turned it down because I told our director that my family, who had been with me through all this and picked me up on passes and stuff, and, you know, my husband wanted to work on renewing our relationship. And we had seen my counselor, my therapist, who was an absolute jewel to work me through all the trauma and stuff from my childhood. And I was able to forgive my parents and go to their graves over off Whitlock and say, I'm sorry, I forgive you, and to feel sorry for them because they did not know recovery. That was huge for me. I have friends, you know, we started with a little prayer list, and at first I had a couple names, you know, family and stuff, and then all of a sudden, you know, a few months later, I had like 15 people on there. It was wonderful. Anyway, when I went to court, and I told her, I said, I want to work on this with Chris and Jackson and my son, because they've never had a sober mother, a sober wife, a sober anything, and I've never been one. And so in 2012, in March, when I transitioned out, by that time we had lost our house that we had built in West Cobb, and that was okay, because that was a really foolish thing to do anyway, but we moved into a small rental in Smyrna, and I continued to work at Hope Homes and to work on my program and go to meetings and get involved with the recovering community there, and I loved it. I felt like I was home. And I gained self-esteem and I gained self-confidence, and I can actually stand up here and talk to a huge room of people and not be, not be able not to talk and not to shake like a leaf. And that's because we're all family here. And this isn't a pass or fail situation. The only way I can fail is if I pick up a drink, you know, and then you're going to, you know, I can come right back. I hope I never pick up another drink. I try to remember very much where I came from so that I don't go back there. I had no idea recovery is what it is. I thought it was just not drinking. You know, I thought it was just being the square. That you guys were a cult and, you know, whatever I thought. But as I was at Hope Homes and able to get engaged in the program, I fell in love with it. I fell in love with the fellowship of AA. I began to like and love myself. And when that recovery horizon kept, that sun kept coming up further and further on that horizon, it was just the most awesome thing ever. And I love you guys and I love it. And today I can, my younger son who was in big trouble with drugs and alcohol and people, and he's completely made a turnaround. Sobriety has brought me and my family so much wonderful things in life. It's not always great. My second year in recovery, my aunt died. And my apartment building burned up the very next day. And they didn't have insurance, and of course we didn't have renter's insurance because we weren't the renters at Hope Home. So what I had was gone, and I didn't actually, Chris had to take me to the store to Belk's and get some underwear. And it was okay. I had somebody to bury, somebody who had helped me be alive to that day, and then the stuff was just stuff. And that was a miracle to me, and I didn't know how to go through grief sober, but I learned. So that was a tough year. It was a year of learning how to walk through the fire. My third year was sort of a year of discernment and finding new sponsors. And a little over a year ago, we moved back to West Cobb from Smyrna, and so I have become involved back in my old groups. And gotten a new sponsor, someone who was actually my first sponsor that I didn't mind or obey, or do what she told me. But we're now really great friends, and it's so awesome to be a part of today, and to be sober and to not have to feel the four horsemen, the remorse, the complete demoralization. I don't have to be afraid anymore. I was afraid 24/7 before I got into recovery and didn't realize it. And I don't have to be afraid of anything anymore because I have you guys and I have my higher power. And it's brought me through. So I have complete faith in that today. And I'm real grateful to be here and just share my experience, strength, and hope with you guys. And I'm very honored to have been asked to do so. Thank you.